greetings once again to everybody out there at TFMR. Hey, it is another holiday weekend here for the markets. And as we like to do, we often have podcasts that we can leave at the top of the page to get as wide of distribution as we possibly can. And today we have what is a real special treat. If you've been around TFMR for any length of time, you know that going all the way back to this time 4 years ago, we began posting the weekly discussions of John Batchelor and Professor Stephen F. Cohen. And these weekly discussions often detail changing events in the new Cold War and Ukraine and now through the Middle East and elsewhere. This is my distinct honor. That's about all I can say to introduce to everybody Professor Stephen F. Cohen himself. To get a chance to actually speak with him, I just am thrilled. And again, it's really an honor to speak with you, Professor. And thank you so much for spending some time with me.
Well, we've been in touch by email, and I know your work. I know your podcast. So it's kind of nice to meet, even though we're meeting via some kind of technology that I don't fully understand.
You and me both. And I should, you know, you'll see a lot of references to TF Metals and people still call me Turd Ferguson, but you don't have to call me. You can call me Craig if you want. It's perfectly fine.
Okay, Craig. Good.
So
I have to
warn you. Even my mother now calls me Turd. So it's if that slips up, it's okay. But anyway, like I said, Professor, it is an honor to visit with you. I think many others on my site feel as if we have had a graduate level, a master's level course in Russian history and Russian studies taught by you over the last 4 years. I have learned more in listening to you and John each week about Russian history, about world history, than I have learned in years. And again, it all draws back to your experience as Professor Emeritus of Russian Studies at NYU in Princeton. And I should mention, too, the website that you're involved in at eastwestaccord.com is important reading, really on a daily basis for folks, too. But at this critical time, I wanted to kind of address where we stand in the new Cold War with you, and specific to Ukraine. You know, I mentioned that I first started publicizing your interviews with John every week about the time you started them back in 2014 with the Maidan coup, revolution, whatever people want to call it. That was a culmination of events that began, as you discussed last night, with the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Soviet Union in 91. It stretched into the Putin presidency that began after the turn of the century, and then we had the events in Georgia. And then we got to what happened in Ukraine 4 years ago. I've kind of brushed it in broad strokes there, but what color can you add to what led us to that moment 4 years ago in terms of maybe what most folks don't know?
Well, that's a complicated question, what color I can add, because I'm afflicted, for better or worse, with being a historian. You mentioned that I taught at Princeton, where I was director of Russian studies and in the Department of Politics, actually. Then at New York University, in a department that was devoted primarily to Russian studies, but there I was also nominally professor of history. And historians, if they're serious, understand that events did not begin yesterday, which to a certain extent is the way the mass media in the country treats an event. At the same time, most historians need a full university lecture to explain all this. So at Princeton, I had 55 minutes. I taught there 30 years. And NYU, I had 90 minutes. But along the way, I kind of willy-nilly ended up in the media. I was, for almost 20 years, the on-air so-called consultant on Russia for CBS News. And that meant on some evenings on the evening news, then with Dan Rather, I had 90 seconds. So I had to go through an education as well. How do I use the scholarly historical knowledge I have without distorting it? Or talking or writing potted history to bring history to bear on current events. Actually, I first tried this in The Nation magazine, for which I've written many, many years, back in the 80s when I did a monthly column, 900 words, called Sovieticus. And that's where I began to train myself to compress historical perspectives in a way that contexted current events. So the answer, reasonably short, not 55 minutes, to your question is, is I see Ukraine and most else, even so-called Russiagate today, in the larger context of a new Cold War between the United States and now post-Soviet Russia. I've been worrying in print and in broadcast about the onset of a new Cold War since the late 1990s, because I saw the Clinton administration's intrusive policies in then Yeltsin's Russia as generating a backlash that would lead the two countries, excuse me, Craig, to a replication or continuation of the 45-year Cold War that Reagan and Gorbachev and then the first President Bush said they had ended in 1989, 1990. And that has unfolded more or less in the worst ways that I worried about. I don't think anybody would deny that today we're in a new Cold War. I think they're slow in acknowledging that it's even more dangerous for various ways and reasons than was the 45-year Cold War. But one reason is, and this was not the case during the old Cold War, is that we are militarily eyeball to eyeball with Russia on three new Cold War fronts. One, of course, is Ukraine, which in a way is the epicenter. But because of NATO's, I think, reckless military buildup on Russia's western borders, particularly in the Baltic region, but also to a certain extent in Syria, where the situation is very fluid and still dangerous, the Cold War could erupt into an actual hot war very easily. Mm-hmm. And I guess, though the danger seemed maybe a year ago to be first and foremost in Syria, because Ukraine seemed, since 1914, rather frozen, now it's shifted back to Ukraine. We got to stop and think what that means. Ukraine as a nation, and then as a state following the end of the Soviet Union in 1991, was always fraught with historical, religious, ethnic, economic, political divisions. Simply holding Ukraine together as a unitary state was going to be a problem. But everyone managed. It wasn't pretty, but they managed until the events of 2014, when we all remember the Maidan protest. And let's remember what they were about. The legally, constitutionally elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, declined to sign a so-called European Union partnership agreement. Seemed very benign. It was just said to be civilizational and economic. And it was said that that would bring Ukraine into European civilization and, of course, away from Russia. Now, Ukraine and Russia had been bound at the hip. People don't mention this often, but there are tens of millions of intermarriages. It's hard not to go to Moscow and spend some time and not find someone who's got a Ukrainian and Russian parent or grandparent.
Right.
But this happened. And it also needs to be reminded that Yanukovych did not refuse to sign that agreement. He simply asked for more time. But that set off protests driven by all sorts of people, some benign, democratic-seeking, liberal, virtuous, fine people in Ukraine, but also by people who were, by any definition, ultra-nationalists and even quasi-fascists.
Yeah, neo-Nazis.
And that led, of course, to the confrontation. Yanukovych was driven illegally from office. A new illegal government was formed, backed by the United States and Europe. Russia, for various reasons that I think were legitimate, feared that the unrest would spread to the historical Russian peninsula of Crimea, which most of its history for centuries had been part of Russia, but because of a kind of fluke was now territorially part of Ukraine. The Russians therefore welcomed and encouraged a referendum in Crimea, by all standards, including Gallup polls that were taken later, more than 80% voted to join Russia. And so Russia legally annexed in 2014. They don't call it annexed, they call it reunited with Crimea. Meanwhile, the mostly Russian provinces of Donbass, part of Crimea, objected to the coup in Kiev that had overthrown the president they had voted for, Yanukovych. His electorate was not only in southeastern Ukraine, but it was primarily there. So they believed that their president had been overthrown and a rebellion began, backed by Russia, of course. And the war has gone on now nearly 4 years.
Yep.
The official number of dead is 10,000, but it's surely many more. And perhaps 2 million people who lived in southeastern Ukraine have been displaced, most of them gone to Russia. Incidentally, Russia gets no credit for the very humanitarian way that it handled all these people, refugees, who fled to Russia. Now, of course, it was easier because they were Russian speakers, but a great many of them have rebuilt their lives vocationally and in terms of their family in Russia. And whether they'll ever go back to Ukraine is not clear. So that's where the situation was. Kind of frozen. There was this agreement, as you know, called the Minsk II agreement.
Right.
That all the European powers agreed to, that the president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, agreed to, that Putin agreed to, for a resolution of the crisis. And in one word, it called for two things. A cessation along a designated line of the fighting, and Kiev's agreement that Donbass would be given enough home rule to remain within what would essentially be a federated Ukrainian state. No one has ever suggested a better or alternative solution to that during the years since Minsk was formalized in 2015. By all evidence, both sides have violated the agreement, but above all, Kiev, because it has refused to grant any home rule to the rebel provinces. And that we know from history, whether it's from the Irish Civil War or other diverse countries, is the only way to save a state, is to make it a federation. But the opposition to it in Ukraine among ultra rightist is enormous. The president, Poroshenko, is weak, both as a person, a leader, and in terms of his public support at home. The United States has done nothing to encourage the real implication of Minsk. And so it remains this hot front.
Right.
And one can imagine all sorts of bad outcomes, including, because it's now a proxy war in Donbass, that is, the rebels are backed by Russia. Kiev is backed by the United States. That proxy war could become a direct war. And a final point, and this has been long-winded, but I'll end, is that ever since Obama was trying to figure out what to do about Ukraine, the idea of the United States sending more and higher quality weapons to Kiev to presumably suppress the rebellion in Donbass, though formally it's said to ward off a new Russian attack, of which there is no evidence or intention. Obama refused to do it. He was under enormous pressure, especially from the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, which has become very hawkish, and he refused to do it. It seemed clear from Donald Trump's campaign that he would never do it, because he wanted to cooperate with Russia. And yet, he has been compelled, I think, to agree to send weapons to Kiev. When and what they'll send isn't yet clear, but it can only make matters worse. Right. Only make matters worse. And that's where we are today.
And that, it sadly is where we are today. And that was the reason for ringing you up and bringing you on the line to discuss these events, to get everybody up to speed. I want to back up, though, Professor Cullen, and just ask you if you think I'm perceiving this correctly, because these are my opinions that I've learned not only obviously from listening to you and John every week, but from my own research and the site I run and everything else that I do for a living. The story that's out there that's been put forth by the Western media since 2014 is that there was this peaceful, you know, revolution in Kiev, some democratic sort of revolution where the people took over, and that the Russians didn't like that, and that they feared they wanted to reestablish their Soviet empire in a way, and so they moved into Crimea and southeast Ukraine. And thus now they must be stopped at every possible advance, whether it's the Baltics or in Ukraine. But what I quickly knew and again discovered before I even started hearing you, John, talk about was the notion that Maidan coup was not, I mean, it was a coup. We know about the call from Victoria Nuland to the U.S. ambassador, you know, talking about we got to get our guy in there. We'll get Klitschko in there, or Yats, right, was the other guy. From a Russian perspective, and again, all we ever get is the Western or the U.S. or the NATO perspective, but there are always two sides. And from the Russian perspective, I always thought that they looked at this as an unnecessary and provocative expansion of NATO, once again, as NATO's been doing for 20-some-odd years now. And thus, yeah, again, if I were Putin, what would I have done? I'd look at Crimea, which is really their only warm water port. They're only linked directly into the West, their only piece of influence, you know, where they can affect things. And all of a sudden, that's in jeopardy, right? Because as you said, it's a part of Ukraine. And they could see where this was going. They could see the U.S. and NATO were behind what was going on in Ukraine. So therefore, they acted proactively. They said, look, we're not going to lose this. It would be as if, and tell me if you think my analogy is correct. I know it's kind of a stretch, but it's as if the U.S. had no naval ports on the West Coast and our only projection of power into the Pacific was through Pearl Harbor. And yet suddenly there was a threat that the Hawaiian Islands were going to be taken over by some other party. The U.S. would act, I would think, to preserve Pearl Harbor. I've always kind of tried to look at it from that perspective. And so the idea that Russian expansion, Putin expansion, you know, trying to reform the Soviet Empire is all based on this notion that they were the ones that were taking the action when instead they were only really reacting to what the U.S. and NATO had done. Is that a, I guess, long question, but is that the proper way, do you think, to look at it?
I think it's perfectly proper. There's nothing wrong with it except one thing. It isn't large enough. The situation from the Russian point of view was even worse. I mean, Crimea, and to understand this, you have to know Russian history, know Russians, know Crimea. Crimea, historically, culturally, was such a part of Russia for so many centuries, right through the Soviet period, that it would be, this is a bit of a stretch, as if to say that Texas, because it once belonged to Mexico, was not authentically, indigenously, a native part of America.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but even more, because the cultural romance of Crimea, the site, I mean, the home of Chekhov, Chekhov's dacha was in Yalta. It's iconic in Russian history, Russian culture, and Russian sentiment. It wasn't just the naval base at Sevastopol, which was vitally important, although the Russians, which had been leasing the naval base, and by the way, what happened at Maidan called into question whether Kiev would honor that long-term lease any longer. You're absolutely right about that. But Russia was building in the far north an alternative naval base. I mean, technically, it could have replicated Crimea strategically. It could have done this. But it could never have replicated Crimea in the hearts and minds of Russians. And as poll after poll and the referendum showed, in the hearts and minds of some 80% of the Crimean people. Now, Crimea also has Tatar Crimeans and Ukrainians who don't share this view. But the overwhelming majority of Crimeans who were born there or moved there or lived there for decades. That was their sentiment. Now, here's the political background. Nonetheless, in all the years I followed post-Soviet Russia, beginning in 1991, I never saw any Kremlin leadership give any indication that it was going to take Crimea back. Let me repeat that. You could not find, certainly not in the public record, who knows what dreams, you know, these kinds of people have in the Pentagon and elsewhere, secretly in the dark of the night. But neither Yeltsin nor Putin ever gave any public support to the idea, which you could find in Moscow in some intellectual circles, that, you know, Krim nash, Crimea is ours. Never. In fact, at one point, they needed to draw new maps because Crimea was now no longer in Russia after 1991. And Putin wrote to the president of Crimea, I don't recall which one it was, saying, hey, our map people want to get on with the new maps. Could you get your map people working with them? Because there's a number of borders that aren't clear and we got to clarify them. And he got no response. In other words, the notion that Crimea might be taken or even negotiated back into Russia simply was not on the political agenda for the Kremlin under Putin until 2014. Now, it's true that on the eve of Putin becoming president, there was a strong political alternative to him, a group in Moscow, headed by the mayor of Moscow, then Yuri Lushkov, who did advocate bringing Crimea back into Russia, not by force, but by some kind of negotiation. And he kind of made that part of his political platform. And he would go to Crimea frequently and advocate it. And he had allies. But he got absolutely no traction in Russia. They unsuccessfully challenged Putin. Putin won the election in 2000. And that was the end of that as a political movement in Russia. And I can say this with some authority because I know very well one of the younger political leaders in Russia who for years and years has advocated bringing Crimea back, again, not by war, but by some referendum or negotiation or something. And it's been his dream to do that. And he's campaigned politically. And he's lost every election he stood in Russia. So this was not an issue. Remember also that in January 2014, the Sochi Russian Olympic Games had just completed.
Right.
A great success for Putin. Everybody said they would be a disaster, and the $50 billion spent to turn Sochi into an Olympic complex would be a catastrophe. But in fact, at least until this doping scandal, and whether or not it's valid or not, I don't know, cropped up about a year ago, Putin was bathing in the in his success at Sochi. So why would he, a week or two later, suddenly decide to incite some kind of rebellion in Ukraine or Crimea? It
Precisely.
Makes no sense.
Precisely.
Particularly since the message he wanted to send to the world via the Sochi Olympic Games was, excuse me, Russia's back on its feet. It's a highly civilized, sovereign, but also Western nation, now prepared to be partners with the Western world in a way that the Olympic Games exemplify. Why would he spoil all that? Not to mention the $50 billion and all the political capital he vested in Sochi. By the way, Henry Kissinger made this point, and he's not a sentimental man. Why would Putin do such a thing? And the answer is, he didn't do such a thing. The events at Maidan, particularly in February, when Yanukovych was driven from office, a kind of coup, were the result of NATO's relentless drive eastward after the end of the Cold War, after the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Right.
And it was often said in Washington by very authoritative people that in this march toward Russia, NATO's march toward Russia, Ukraine was, I quote, the brass ring the ultimate prize. Everybody knew this. I mean, in 2008, President George W. Bush openly advocated giving both Ukraine and Georgia fast-track membership into Ukraine, either though neither country qualified, and it was vetoed by Germany and France, who understood the folly of it. But the American Washington bipartisan intention was clear to everyone, including the Russians. So you're right in saying that it was NATO expansion that led to the Ukrainian crisis. But you have to put this in the context of the importance of Crimea sentimentally, not just the naval base, into Russia, but on the other hand, that there was absolutely no political movement, and certainly not in the Kremlin, to do anything to take back Crimea until the crisis of 2014. So I ask myself, and you and I don't know how to ask this question, because we've never been in this position. But what does a national leader and the leader of a great power do when faced with such a crisis? He or she is entirely dependent on advisors, and particularly on intelligence sources. I mean, the Russian equivalent of the NSA and the CIA and all the intelligence had to tell Putin what they thought was the vulnerability of Crimea in that moment when the president of Ukraine had been overthrown and replaced by a government backed by the United States. Putin had options. He could do nothing and hope for the best. He could let the referendum in Ukraine go ahead because they had secretly polled and they knew it was going to be overwhelmingly for rejoining Russia. But he could have just said, okay, we hear you, but we're going to wait and see. And he could have used that referendum as a bargaining chip with the West about the status of Ukraine. It would have been a powerful bargaining chip that if you want Crimea to stay in Ukraine, if you want Russia not to act on the referendum, you people in the West have to produce a civilized government in Kiev that will negotiate with us. He didn't take those two options. Instead, he supported the referendum, and they did what they did, and they brought Crimea back into Russia. Now, there are various reports, public and some not public, about what Putin was told. But some of the intelligence information, I can't say it's valid, but you have to remember, this is what Putin is receiving. And as a former intelligence agent himself, we have to assume that he has to know when intelligence agencies are misleading him. He has to know how to read the information. He was told things so dire that he felt he had no choice. Now, history will judge when the archives are opened whether that's a correct analysis. But you have to put yourself, as should American presidents, in his position.
Right.
What would an American president have done given right. such a situation, let's say in Mexico or Canada or at Pearl Harbor, as you say? And it's hard to imagine any Russian leader, even those that we imagine in our minds to be just like us, acting any differently.
Right. So lastly, Professor Cohen, because I want to be respectful of your time, just to tie this all together to where we stand at present. These events, as they've been spun in the Western media, have made it out, you know, where Russia is the aggressor, and thus NATO has to act by propping up the Kiev government, even if, you know, we have to resort to using the units like the Azov battalion, you know, the neo-fascist, whatever you want to call those guys. I mean, they're not good guys. Or whether we got to put NATO troops in the Baltic states, thus on Russia's western border, there are now potentially hostile troops for the first time since 1941. All these provocative actions that we're being told have to be done defensively because of these actions that Russia has somehow taken unprovoked. And now it's led us to this point where, as you stated earlier, between Christmas and New Year's, these stories were put out that were largely missed around the internet, in the media, that President Trump is now going to go ahead and begin sending arms to the Ukrainians, to the Kiev forces. Those arms could include sniper rifles, sniper rifle ammunition. I've even seen reports, Professor, of Javelin anti-tank missiles. This is now taking things to a whole new level, very dangerous level. And so my last question is, how dangerous is 2018? And lastly, what can anyone do? The people listening to you and I on my site and elsewhere, are we just helpless? I mean, do we just simply dig a bomb shelter? I mean, how can we somehow impact events at the grassroots level? Is there anything we can do?
Do I have a little time to answer by digression?
As much as you'd like, sir. I just want to be protective of your time, so go ahead.
No, I'm happy to be with you. Well, the short answer is, how dangerous is the situation in Ukraine? And again, remembering that Ukraine is part of a larger new Cold War that extends to the Baltic regions, also Russia's borders, and to Syria, where American and Russian combat forces are flying way too close to each other, and that accidents could happen. The Russians have already said that in Syria, the Americans abetted some jihadists who killed a Russian general. And they have warned that if the Americans get anywhere close again to the Russian area of operation, they will shoot down those American airplanes. So let us just imagine what would happen if that's the case. So I would say that when you ask, is the situation in Ukraine, in this larger context, dangerous? I would say at least as dangerous as was the Cuban Missile Crisis. But more dangerous because we have so tripled Trump with these charges that he's somehow a Kremlin puppet, that he does not have the political space to negotiate in a crisis the way that John Kennedy did when he ended the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think this is unprecedentedly dangerous. That's the first thing that needs to be said. The second thing is this issue of neo-Nazis or neo-fascists in Ukraine. This story is reported in the United States only in small alternative media. It's not part of the narrative of the New York Times, the Washington Post, MSNBC, or CNN, which drive the political discussion agenda and thus policy agenda in Washington. I grew up in the Jim Crow South in Kentucky, in a completely segregated society. I lived among white supremacists all my life. I follow Europe today somewhat, and I see the rise of white supremacists, maybe neo-Nazi movements, in European countries. I understand the concern about this in the United States when they show up in Charlottesville or when they get a sizable vote in France or Austria or elsewhere. But they are nothing compared to what is ignored in Ukraine.
Right.
And that is avowedly neo-Nazi battalions, not only Azov, armed battalions, whose public profile, self-professed, includes admiration for Hitler and admirations for the Ukrainian fascist armies and battalions that fought with Hitler and killed tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Jews and Poles during World War II.
Yep.
They are so influential in Kiev. They are not marginal, Craig. I mean, if they're mentioned here in the American press, it's kind of, oh, by the way, there's these curious chaps who say these funny things.
Right.
These are people with power, not electoral power, but the power of the gun, that have compelled the Kiev government under Poroshenko to build memorials to Jew killers in the capital of Ukraine, Kiev. And they continue to do this throughout the country without any resistance. Israel has occasionally protested, but there is no protest in the United States Congress to speak of, none whatsoever, no editorials in the New York Times or the Washington Post about this. So when we worry about our rather pathetic motley group of white supremacists who've been around since I was a kid. And, I mean, they have their right to march and protest, and it's good because we show how marginal they really are, while at the same time paying no attention to the rebirth of armed stormtrooper-like, muscular, politically potent neo-fascist in Ukraine. Something is going on in the United States that's very, very bad. Mm-hmm. And I would end by saying two things. It's not quite right to say that the United States has not been supplying Kiev with weapons until now.
Yeah, that's true. It's
because there are vast warehouses of NATO armaments in all NATO countries, surplus armaments made in the United States that have been shipped through third parties to Kiev since 2014. Add on to this the memory that when Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union, Ukraine was part of the arsenal of Soviet military might. The defense complex in Ukraine was large and potent, and the Kiev government inherited most of those weapons. The rebels got some. And it's true that they needed new parts and spare parts to activate them, but they got them. So the Kiev army has been exceedingly well armed. It just doesn't want to fight. That's the problem. It's officers and it's conscripted soldiers who defect at alarming rates, do not want to fight. They have not bought into this civil war of shooting their brethren in Donbass. So the danger here is twofold with these new weapons. And maybe, as you say, the javelins and the sniper, anti-sniper equipment will give Kiev something it doesn't have. But the danger here is that Kiev will regard this as a signal from Washington that it should launch a new military operation against Donbass. And that will result in two things. A lot of more dead people, innocent civilians, but also another major military catastrophe for Kiev.
Right.
Because it's not weapons they lack. It's the will of the armed forces or its ability to fight. And if Kiev suffers another military catastrophe, as it's already done twice, that might open the door to actual power to the neo-Nazis. That might be just enough for them to take power in Ukraine. So the risks of this, which is the last thing, of course, that Vladimir Putin wants, well, let's recall that if we escalate by shipping weapons, it's much easier for Putin to match that escalation because Russia shares the border with Ukraine. They simply truck the new equipment or roll it into the Donbass. So this is utter folly, but I worry most of all that Kiev, a failing government, made desperate by a failing economic, political, and social situation in Kiev, in Ukraine, will try to save itself by a brief victorious war. Many governments have tried this, and that would lead to the worst imaginable outcome.
Yeah, and not only empowering maybe that Azov battalion and the likes and the neo-Nazis, that NATO could use it as an invitation to get further involved too, wouldn't you say?
Well, I mean, that's a threshold.
Yeah, exactly.
That I haven't thought through. Further involved would presumably mean, because there has been a plan, contingency plan for this in Brussels, to send NATO troops into Western Ukraine.
Exactly.
But the problem here politically is that the Western Ukrainians, which have the largest demographic, electoral, and social base for this extreme nationalism, are now in a political rhetorical war with Poland.
Well, that's right, too.
Because the Poles are not happy about the way these Western Ukrainians, and through them Kiev, have rehabilitated the Ukrainian forces that killed so many Poles during World War II. And this has become a kind of spitting match between the Polish and Ukrainian government. So that is a highly unstable factor and frontier within the heart of NATO itself. To cross that line could be a catastrophe not only for NATO, but for the European Union.
Right.
Because Poland is moving very, very quickly to the right and bringing it, because of the conflicting histories, into a clash with Ukraine. And by the way, the same is true in Hungary. There's a sizable Hungarian diaspora in Ukraine. So this whole situation is fraught with several Ukraines that could be detonated into a larger civil war by more NATO intervention.
Yeah.
One would think that even the crazies in Brussels see these red lines.
You'd like to think that, that's for certain. And to that end, that final question, Professor, about, you know, in opposition to these war parties. Yeah, what can we do?
Well, I am in a complex situation. I'm not much of a political activist, though I was during the civil rights struggle and during the Vietnam War. But I'm not involved in the Democratic Party, but I've been a kind of knee-jerk liberal Democratic voter over the years. But still more, my wife, Katrina VandenHeuvel, is the editor of The Nation magazine, which is the single most important publication of the liberal left political community in the United States, including in Washington. They have gone on, though less so The Nation, but in part also The Nation, on this crazy resistance to Trump as an illegitimate president campaign that's manifested itself in the unproved allegations of Russiagate. And it appears that the Democratic Party is not going to stop, that it thinks, rightly or wrongly, that this will be a winning ticket in 2018, this accusation that Trump is a Kremlin agent. And it just has become a form of, I don't know what you call it, mania, hysteria,
yeah,
madness. Every day there's something new. When the liberal Democratic Senator Benjamin Cardin has now produced a report, I think, out today that Putin's not only attacking American democracy, but democracies all around the world. They made Putin essentially larger, more formidable, and more dangerous than was the entire Soviet communist threat. I mean, they really have done that.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. So this brings us, what can we do to this? I can say the cliched thing that we educate ourselves. We try to talk to our political representatives, both Republican and Democrats, and alert them to the grave dangers of the new Cold War and how Russiagate is making it worse. And the or is fraught with all sorts of unpleasantry here in the United States, we can actually support Donald Trump's campaign promise, which I think he's tried to act on since he's been president, that it's necessary to cooperate with Russia. This is what was called détente in the 20th century. I don't know why Trump doesn't make this point. I don't think he has very good advisors in regard to Russia, either in terms of what's going on in Russia or in terms of his own policy making. But Trump might say, in his own defense, because they're indicting him for simply saying, I want to cooperate with Russia and with Putin in particular, he could say, look, every a Republican president of consequence in the 20th century pursued détente with Russia. First Eisenhower, the first détente, the spirit of Camp David with Khrushchev. Then the Nixon-Kissinger attempt at a grand détente with Brezhnev. And finally, above all, Ronald Reagan, a détente with Gorbachev, the last Soviet-Russian leader, so great that Reagan and Gorbachev thought they had ended the Cold War. Trump could put himself in that tradition and say, I'm the traditional Republican. This is what Eisenhower, Nixon, and Reagan did. They did it wisely, They avoided nuclear war with Russia. We're in a new Cold War. The dangers are grave. It's not only my duty as the American president to pursue cooperation to ward off a catastrophe, but I am in the honorable tradition of the Republican Party. He doesn't say that. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he doesn't say it, because he doesn't know it or because he wants to be the one and only. I have no idea. But he needs to say it. And if he said it, it would compel a conversation in Washington that we're not having. What's happened to detente? And what's happened is we have, if we ignore his own idiom and put it in, again, I speak as a historian, the historical language of 20th century diplomacy, we have a pro-detente president who, for the first time in history, is not permitted to at least try. Because every time he has a sensible conversation with Putin, no matter whether it's face-to-face or on the telephone, he's accused not only by the traditionally crazies in American politics, but by the New York Times of treason.
Yeah.
So what we could do, and it will be hard for a lot of people because the loathing for Trump is so pervasive. Just to, and I didn't vote for Trump as the Fifth Amendment. I didn't vote for Trump and I didn't support President Trump. But about this, he's not only right, he's our only hope at the moment.
Yeah.
So one possibility is simply to say, no matter all else, we support Donald Trump's attempt to cooperate with Russia because it's existential. Now, would enough of us do that? Would a few newspapers do that? Would a few of these cable TV panelists, would they ever have panelists on who would do that? We might affect a little civic courage in Congress, where a few people there would do so also. But at the moment, you have a complete blackout on this perspective in the American political media arena, and you have an utter lack of civic courage among political figures and editors who know better but have been frightened by this Russiagate business.
Unfortunately, that's a pretty good summation, Professor Cohen. Gosh, there's so much more to ask you.
Well, I'll end with a depressing footnote.
Okay. We've got leave it on a high note.
I lived in Brezhnev's Soviet Russia in Moscow for a very long time in the late 70s and early 80s. And I lived among dissidents. They were my personal friends, and I helped them in my own way. But also among ordinary, professional, middle-class Soviet citizens who did not agree with their own government and who took grave risks in challenging the censorship or official policy. Not just being arrested, but they could lose their jobs, their kids could be expelled from the university. I saw more civic courage in Soviet Russia and Moscow during those days than I see in the United States political establishment today.
Yeah.
There are no profiles of courage.
Yeah. Now, like you said, maybe through hard work we can inspire some, because that is about all that we can do, sadly, at this point, besides being...
Or worst scenario, we wait for a catastrophe
yeah.
that finally awaken and arouse them. But by then, it would be too late.
Yeah. Well, my friend, it has been extraordinarily insightful. And like I said, the last 4 years have been so beneficial to me and to everybody here at TFMR. I hope, though, there's so many other things I'd like to ask you. I hope at some point we'll be able to speak again, Professor Cohen. Hopefully the situation won't be such that, we feel forced to. But I hope to sometime pick your brain again about some of the other details surrounding this new Cold War. But for now, again, I just can't thank you enough for volunteering some of your time today to spend with us and enlighten us and give us this additional perspective. Nothing could be more valuable at this point in history, so thank you.
Well, thanks to you, too.
And to everybody out there listening, thank you for your time, and we will speak to you again sometime soon.